This is the Vorpal Network.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by FRP Games, where overstock discounts range from 30 to 90% off, and NobleKnightGames.com, where out of stock is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
This is Robert J. Schwalb, the Prince of Darkness of Gaming, and I'm here on The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 141. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I'm going to explore my dark side with Robert J. Schwalb as he gives us some tips on evil PCs in a game. First, let me introduce the guest of the episode, Robert J. Schwalb, one of my favorite game designers, especially when he embraces the vile side. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to know Mr. Schwalb in more detail, and we're going to get into that a lot, I want to mention one bit of Tome news. Specifically, I'm going to Gen Con. It's my first ever Gen Con. I've reported to you guys from Gen Con for years now, but it's always been me sending correspondence in my place, and I've never actually been able to go myself. So this year, it's my turn. And I'd love to meet you there. You can find me at a lot of the official Wizards of the Coast seminars and that kind of thing, where I'll be either recording or reporting as much as I can. But even easier, you can find me at the media meet and greet, where podcasters and bloggers from around the internet are all going to be gathering in one spot in hopes of meeting each other and you guys. It's at 8 p.m. on Saturday at the convention, so I hope to see anybody who's at Gen Con at that. Now, let's get to know Mr. Schwalb. Are you going to be at Gen Con this year?
I will indeed. Yeah, I'm going to be there for the entire show. It kicks off with my birthday. I'm very excited.
Well, I'm sure they scheduled it just for that reason.
They totally did. Peter and the kids, they all just kind of lined up and said, you know, I think it's time to celebrate Rob's birthday. And so they just throw it on that day instead. It should be fun.
Yeah, that was very generous of them.
It is.
Let's get to know you a little bit more. Could you give us some of your history? What is your journey as a game designer looked like?
Sure. So my career started with an open call from Mongoose Publishing way, way, way back, I guess, in 01. I pitched The Quintessential Witch, and that kind of started me. I struggled for a little while after that. I got landed a job with Green Ronin Publishing, The Unholy Warrior's Handbook. And then the big job that kind of launched my career was the Grimm for Fantasy Flight Games, where you play children that go into a twisted fairy tale world. That landed me a job at Green Ronin Publishing, where I worked as D20 line developer for several years, and then Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay line developer. I designed, Black Company campaign setting, things for the Razor and the Apple for True 20, Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game, and managed and designed probably about 70% of the Warhammer fantasy role-play line during its second edition. After that, towards the tail end of my career at Green Ronin, I was doing some freelance work for Wizards of the Coast, starting with Tome of Magic, Player's Handbook 2, Fiendish Codex 2, a couple other books, Elder Evils, Exemplars of Evils, and then I actually left Green Ronin shortly after that to work full-time on Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition as a freelancer. And my first book for 4th Edition was Draconomicon 1 and Forgotten Realms Player's Guide and Martial Power. And I've been pretty much steadily on 4th Edition ever since.
Yeah, it seems like they can't publish a book or go through a single week of DDI articles without seeing your name on something.
Well, you know, it's I guess I can be persuasive. I don't
you certainly seem to be somebody that Wizards of the Coast trusts and likes to lean on for design work. So,
well, I've cultivated some really good relationships with the people that work for Wizards, and I have not only are they kind of my dark masters, but they're also good friends. And they've given me a lot of opportunities that, you know, and allow me to be able to do what I do for a living and still be able to. And I think we have a pretty good exchange. I'm able to give them dedicated product, and at the same time, they give me something to do.
Very cool.
So it's a, yeah.
So What sort of things have you worked on recently that we should be keeping an eye out for? Things that are coming out, well, that have just come out or coming out in the next month or so. What could we look for from you?
So the next big release is August, in fact, and that's going to be kind of a pretty much heavy release schedule for my stuff. We're kicking off with Psionic Power. It's the list of the Power Source books, and we're giving new builds for the Ardent, Battle Mind, Monk, and Scion, with supporting feats and Paragon Paths and Epic Destinies and some new magic items and actually some pretty nifty neato tweaks to races and stuff like that as well. Following on the hot on the heels of that, in fact, the same day, you'll see the Dark Sun campaign setting and Dark Sun creature catalog, both of which I contributed to fairly heavily. In fact, Dark Sun pretty much swallowed up my life last summer. So it's going to be nice to see those come out. And then towards the end of this year, we have Famine in Fargo, which is the first expansion set for Gamma World. And that should that's super exciting. That was my last project I did in 2009. And it is wacky, crazy fun. The new Gamma World rules are really, really create a fast-paced, fun play experience that allows you to pretty much do whatever you want as far as character concepts and creation and weirdness. So if you want to play, for example, a tracked Yeti, you can do it in Gamma World. Yeah, but more on that later.
All right.
Cool. So those are the big things.
So, and you started to bleed into this area as well. What do you have sort of in the further future that we should be looking forward to? Anything that you can, that has been announced anyway that you can tell us about?
The only thing I think I can tell you about is actually confirm the existence of a book. And that is Heroes of Shadow, that comes out, I believe it was in the first trimester catalog for 2011. And that is, I believe a March release and that's pretty much all I can say about that right now. I will tell you that, it is super sexy. And you should. I think everyone's going to dig this book.
Right on. And is that part of the Essentials line?
No, the Essentials line is a closed line of books that is it's 10 products, right, plus a dice pack. This takes a lot of cues from Essentials, but it is its own thing.
Okay, very cool.
Still D&D.
Still D&D. Good. That's been a topic of much conversation lately. So
it has. I just want to reiterate, because I know that a lot of people, wizards, have been kind of trying to put out some fires, that some people are suggesting that Essentials is 4.5. It's really not. It's just a new way of a play. It doesn't invalidate anything that's come before, where 3.5 was kind of like the death of a thousand cuts, where there are all sorts of little rules changes that kind of made it almost a new edition. Essentials doesn't really change anything fundamental about the game. Skills are the same. Classes can be played from any book. It's basically the same game, just with it's packaged differently, and it makes it easier to engage this product, engage the hobby through the way it's being presented. So I think if that puts any fears to rest, I'm not sure that I'm the guy who's going to be doing that, but I want to reaffirm fans that Essentials is not a new half edition or a full edition at all.
And you are somebody who tends to be – You're not full time at Wizards, but you're more in the know than the average Joe.
Yeah, and it's I say that, but I'm also sometimes the last guy to know. But I'm very confident that, for example, I whipped up an Essentials fighter for my game last night to kind of see how it play along everything else, and. I just kind of didn't actually reveal it to anybody, but I was just kind of seeing how it would stack up against other players' character sheets. And, you know, it would fit just fine. And I can imagine that the play experience, since my players are not under NDA, so they don't get to see all the fun stuff. But I imagine that it'd be seamless, as as you can get.
Okay. Very cool. All right. Well, today we're going to talk about how DMs can think about designing encounters for evil PCs. Then we're going to talk about playing an evil PC in a party that may or may not be all evil. And then we're going to also have some segments from Sly Flourish giving some DM tips and Sarah Dark Magic giving some players tips. But before we get into that, I want to mention our first sponsor of the episode, FRP Games. And my pick for this episode is the 4th edition Dark Sun campaign setting available for pre-order for less than $32 at FRP Games. This book isn't out yet, so I can't tell you much. If only there was someone that I could reach out to that had the inside scoop that might be able to talk a little bit about it that, you know, might have their name on the cover.
I guess that would be me. So Dark Sun is, well, as everyone probably knows by now, Dark Sun is a return to a classic second edition setting. It marks a departure from how we've presented campaign settings up until this point. Previously, you would see the campaign guide and a player's guide as separate products and a supporting adventure. We're keeping the supporting adventure, but rather than divide the world information between two books, we opted to combine them into one book, one thick book, that will then include DM advice, player advice, and all the nuts and bolts you need to run it. And then the creature compendium catalog is like a monster manual expansion product. So it's going to have all sorts of cool creatures that come from second edition, along with the Sorcerer Kings and plot hooks and quests and locations and all sorts of neat stuff. In the Dark Sun campaign guide, though, I believe the first half of the book is really geared towards the players. We've been revealing little bits here and there, but this month we're starting the Dark Sun previews as we're building up towards Gen Con. So we did our best to try to not invalidate anything that's come before in second edition, to kind of marry the fourth edition version of the game to the second edition of the game, so that for players who've been playing nonstop Dark Sun for 20 years or whatever, it doesn't change anything. But what we did do is turn the clock back so that the core book is around the same time that the first core box from second edition. So Kallak is just dead. The other Sorcerer Kings are alive and well. The plots are starting to thicken. The dragon's still at large, and so on. Right. But what you could do from the starting book is that you could kick off the classic campaign and run through the events of the novels if that's the direction you wanted to go, or forge ahead into a totally different direction.
So it is quite literally taking the second edition Dark Sun and making it a fourth edition Dark Sun without changing the storyline at all, and you can take any materials you've got and translate that and do what you want with it?
For the most part, yeah. There are some things where we just don't talk about. That doesn't mean that it doesn't exist in that world, sure. But we felt like we did not want to put focus on something that there was some discomfort with, and so we just rather than say it doesn't exist or it's changed, we just kind of move ahead. But, you know, the thing is that my point was that I thought that we should be able to present a setting that says, okay, we're going to lay out some parameters as far as what this world's going to be like. We know what Dark Sun was like in the past, and that includes half-giants, moles, humans, Thrycreen, and so on. All those elements are in place. So we're not trying to force in a race like the race that comes from a source book into Dark Sun just to kind of say that every race in D&D land has to be in Dark Sun.
Sure.
If you wanted to play a Shard Mind in Dark Sun, you could, but we're not going to talk about Shard Minds, or I don't believe we do, in the Dark Sun core rulebook, because they just don't have a place in the history of the game. And so, now granted, the Shard Mind, for example, does have a place in D&D canon, and you could easily morph that story into Dark Sun's history, but it's not, it's one of those things where it's like, we want to focus on the setting itself, the world, and the tensions and dramas surrounding the people that are kind of have to live under the oppressive thumb of the Sorcerer Kings.
Sure.
And so that's kind of what we're cooking with.
Great. So if you have an old love of Dark Sun, or you're a new somebody who's new to Dark Sun anyway, and you have an interest in it, you can head to FRP Games through our website and check that out. Pre-order today.
FRP Games is an online retailer specializing in all aspects of your tabletop gaming needs. Whether it's RPGs, dice, war games, or computer games, FRP Games has a wide selection of products. They offer overstock items where you can pick up all kinds of gaming gear ranging from 30% off all the way up to 90% off the retail price. Through our website, you'll be directed to their weekly new products, eBay auctions, or you can even buy your Special Gaming Someone a gift certificate. FRP Games is an authorized Wizards of the Coast retailer and for 10 years has been committed to providing each customer with the highest standard of customer service possible. Visit our website for instant access to FRP Games inventory of thousands of unique gaming items.
Okay, so today, let's get into our first main segment here where we're going to talk about building an encounter for a party of evil PCs, or I should say, let's at least assume a range of evil through unaligned. You know, the party skews evil in their morality. And we're going to put together a little sample story of a party and build an encounter for that party. Or rather, I'm going to build an encounter and Rob here is going to help me along the way to make sure that it's going to work. So I've got some different ideas of how to do that. But let's talk in general first before we get into a specific encounter of what kind of things do we need to consider when we build an encounter for an evil party?
So I would probably start by saying that, you know, there are two broad approaches towards adventure and encounter building in general for D&D. And I think the first one is kind of the player driven, where the players are kind of making the decisions about where they want to go and what they want to do. And the DM then parcels that information that may be related to the storyline or campaign. Then there's also the more tightly scripted campaign approach where players are, you know, the DM kind of takes a top-down approach and says, here's what the ultimate end is going to be, and I'm going to shape the story so that I can kind of control the narrative in a way that allows it to progress towards an ending. I think when you have an evil or an evil-oriented party, I think the latter approach is probably stronger, because otherwise it becomes a masturbatory exercise of everyone indulging their ids. So if characters are evil, that becomes a descriptive element that applies towards a greater narrative arc that becomes realized later on. So I've lost myself. Anyway, so yeah. So in this case, I would say that what we want to do is have a very tight story and give motivation and build in the quest or the lead-in material that gets the characters involved. And make that very structured, and so that there is no deviation. That, you know, not necessarily no deviation, but rather control the number of choices the characters have, the players have to engage the encounter.
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, I think you need to bring the story to the players rather than let them go out and find it. I think that's sort of the direction you're talking about. Because I've played evil characters or had evil parties in previous editions of the game, and it was a little bit easier to pull off because there wasn't this focus on a group dynamic in previous editions like there is in 4th. But at the same time, it always eventually came down to my PC gets mad at your PC and we're evil, so why wouldn't I kill you? You know, and that's the inevitable conclusion unless you have a DM who can really sort of rein that in and say, look, that's fine, but meanwhile, there's a bigger threat out there, and here's the story that's coming to you, and, you know, control some of those choices, as you were saying. Does that sort of fit in line with
that? Yeah, and that's – it does. And I think, you know, another way to kind of help mitigate the dangers and the dangers that are inherent in an evil party is to really introduce a strong patron. So – because one of the things that you just mentioned was that evil characters will – players of evil characters – tend to turn each other at some point and the game ends. If you have a patron, it gives them someone to hate. Everyone can hate. And so the players are then probably working for this patron, but then at the same time, maybe plotting against this character so that one of them can usurp his position. Mm-hmm. And that might be an interesting mechanical choice for like an epic destiny, especially for a big arc. The character is actually working towards replacing their evil overlord. And that gives every player motivation to try to achieve, to strive for that same kind of endpoint.
Yeah, and I think there's some good elements in there. And I think another thing to consider is that it doesn't have to be a story completely on rails, so to speak.
Right.
As a DM, look at those players and figure out, okay, you're evil, fine, but you still have motivations, and use those motivations to bring them the story.
Exactly.
No, go ahead.
That's kind of what I was aiming for, in the sense that I, I don't want to sound like you're stringing the players along, because I think as a player myself, that's probably the thing I hate the most. But at the same time, I think that if you're structuring the barriers or boundaries of the adventure by keeping the players, the characters' interests in mind, I think you certainly can direct gameplay in a way that allows you to achieve story goals without the inevitable collapse, which is exactly what you're saying.
Right. So here's the concept I came up with for our evil party that we're going to deal with today, is that we have a high heroic tier party, levels 8 or 9 or so. And I guess this would fit in well to the concept of Dark Zone that we've talked about earlier as well. They used to be enslaved gladiators, right? They've managed to free themselves, but now they're seeking the power to never be enslaved again. So they don't really care about anybody else. They're not trying to end slavery or anything like that. They just want to make sure that they're powerful enough that nobody can mess with them anymore. So given a party like that, what kind of storylines could you come up with to keep them from killing each other?
So I think that, to kind of go back to what I was saying about the patron, I think that's probably going to be the one way to keep them together. Now, if we're looking at Dark Sun as a story, there are lots of different places there are a lot of different types of characters you could go with in order to kind of unify the group. For starts, let's assume, so the players have just recently become broken free from slavery, so now they're looking to try to make it in the world. As ex-slaves, one Dark Sun kind of storyline would be to have them flee into the wilderness and try to make do there as a new slave tribe, or have to deal with other rival slave tribes in the area. They might work with another slave tribe. And then do what in a normal D&D world would consider a pretty terrible things as raiding caravans and so on. Mm-hmm. Alternatively, you could also take the same party of ex-gladiators and have them maybe they didn't win their liberation themselves, or maybe they were liberated by a merchant house or a ranking Templar who has other plans for them. And so maybe the freedom they're seeking is something that is a carrot that you're dangling in front of them. Mm-hmm. That maybe. And this could be a way that, especially if you're not setting in Tyr, and you put it in another city state, say Draj, which is really nasty, or Nibene, which is not so bad, but it's bad enough. The freedom thing allows the character. It actually could create a situation where the characters may be unaligned, but they have to compromise their values in order to achieve that freedom that they're seeking. So I would probably say a Templar would be probably a pretty cool way to kind of manage these characters.
Okay. So your suggestion with this party is find a patron, but when you say patron, it's not necessarily, since they're evil, it's not necessarily in the traditional sense of, there's somebody you're working for because you have some goals in common. It's somebody you're working for because maybe you're not as free as you want to be. And this patron is going to become the villain later. Once the party has gathered the power necessary to defeat them.
Right.
Okay.
There was in the old days of Dark Sun Second Edition, my friend Bob is a hardcore Dark Sun enthusiast, and he had a Templar named Korvac who filled a similar role. We weren't an evil party by any means, but Korvac was something of a he was our foil, but at the same time he was an occasional ally, which made him an interesting character because we were forced to have to work with him at times. And then at other times we're opposing him. And of course, by the end of the campaign, he had become a full-blown villain, and we had a final confrontation, and that resolves that storyline. So I think something similar here could be pretty interesting, especially if the players are motivated by greed, or motivated by some darker element, with freedom being kind of the ultimate objective, but their means to achieve freedom could be any number of deviant practices.
Okay. So what kind of, given that situation, you're suggesting then that most of the encounters along the way would be that future villain sending them off on various tasks and missions and what have you to further their goals.
Right.
Okay.
And see, the thing is, with also because Dark Sun is a item poor world, there's not going to be a profusion of magic items that are in this play that are in the setting. So with that in mind, the patron could be a facilitator for achieving rare items that they wouldn't ordinarily come across. So maybe the treasure rewards they're going to get are going to be actually rewarded as results of doing these darker and darker missions. Uh-huh. And the patron might be reluctant to give out these items or some other incentives to keep them in his employ. But at the same time, even realizing while he's doing this, that he's actually orchestrating his own undoing. So there could be a breaking point when the PCs hit a certain level of saturation of power that he knows that they're going to turn against him. And that could be the great betrayal that comes midpoint in the story arc, or not the midpoint of story arc, but a midpoint of their careers.
Sure. That's sort of a point where that sounds like the kind of climactic moment that signals the end of a tier. If I'm setting up a campaign, right? You know, the end of heroic or the end of paragon, where they say, you know what, forget this guy, and they go after him, and they really earn their freedom, and who knows what kind of havoc they wreak after that.
Right, right. I think that's I would probably hazard to say that an endpoint for the heroic tier would probably be best here for this one, mm-hmm. largely because at the paragon tier, the characters are going to be affecting more than just the city state, or actually. Because, you know, heroic tier, they're pretty much based in one area, and then the paragon tier takes them beyond their city state and actually can engage in kind of the regional concerns. And then, of course, with the epic tier, you're dealing with a dragon and the sorcerer king mm-hmm. themselves. So, and then you can certainly tie the Templar to the sorcerer king, and the sorcerer king in question could be the campaign villain that's realized at the very end of the paragon tier once the player characters defeat the Templar patron that they had dealt with before. Sure. And I think it's important to maybe set up the patron as maybe not somebody who's, you know, depraved and decadent and super duper evil, because I think we have to make him a compelling enough villain that the players, even though they are playing evil characters, you know, I'm assuming that the players themselves are not, you know, completely, you know, amoral or immoral. So you have to, I think at this point, even though that you might be going on evil missions, it's important that you construct the patron as a compelling character that allows the players to at least make peace with the idea that they're evil characters doing things because they have a villain who's more complicated than the mustache twirling blackguard. So this character, because he's going to have a continual presence throughout the heroic tier, probably into the paragon tier, there probably needs to be some redeeming elements in his personality.
Absolutely. So I had an idea then for a specific camp or for a specific encounter that would work for that might work for this party, given the storyline that we're sort of crafting, where they're working for this patron, where the party is out on a mission and has an opportunity to take a quick tangent to possibly earn themselves enough power to overthrow this patron. And I'm a big fan of using outsiders and devils and that kind of stuff in my game. And I know you've had some history working on that kind of stuff. So that's the direction I decided to go with it. You know, they rush off to find a devil who's and to try to strike a deal with this devil to get the power necessary to break away from their patron. But what they find out is that this devil maybe is not really that interested in helping them seek their freedom. It would just be a new form of enslavement to this devil, whether it be immediate or by corrupting their souls and enslaving them in the afterlife. So I would then, of course, take that and turn that into a combat encounter where the devil calls up his minions and all hell, so to speak, breaks loose. Is that an encounter concept that works for what you're thinking?
Yeah, totally. And in fact, I think that if the devil doesn't reveal his infernal nature until maybe just before this encounter, I think with this particular with another antagonist, this is a way you might introduce this villain. Okay, let's say we were actually the Templar's patron covers the heroic tier. Mm-hmm. The devil comes in at some middle point. And he offers a way out, as you described. There's a revelation that takes him into this fight, which then means that the players may be thinking that, all right, this guy he's not what he thought he was going to be. But they may have expectations about what types of creatures they might be fighting, like maybe household guards or whatever else. Mm-hmm. So what might be interesting would be to have this devil figure. I mean, you could go with a succubus, but I would probably maybe even turn to the Harvester Devil from the Monster Manual 2, and maybe scale it up to an appropriate level or scale it down. And maybe he's just killed a merchant house, a merchant prince, and has taken his position. And so, and then he's been quietly installing either infernal servants, either other devils, or maybe even tieflings, a tiefling tribe that he's maybe recruited from the desert to kind of reinforce his stronghold or his lair, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I think that'd be pretty cool. And then so the characters would go into this fight thinking, all right, we're going to take on a bunch of household guards, and we know this guy, something's funky about this guy. He might be a devil, or they may know he's a devil, so he is a devil, and we're going to have to deal with some infernal powers there, but then have to realize that, you know, this is actually maybe even a portal to some fringe plane or demiplane or some pocket dimension where he's actually using it as a base of operation and can funnel infernal energies from the nine hells or so on. That could be a neat way to kind of to defeat their expectations and put them into a really interesting fight.
Yeah, very cool. So the specific thing what I built around, and tell me if this sounds, because I wanted to see if I could put together this encounter without actually having to modify, because I've been modifying a lot of monsters lately with the monster builder, which is actually fairly easy to do. But I pulled up the Pain Devil Captain from Manual of the Planes.
Sure.
Which is an 11th level controller and a leader to be, you know, the devil that's trying to corrupt them and what have you. And then he's surrounded himself with creatures that very easily, I think, could fit into your idea of being hidden as just, you know, guards. You know, I've got him with a group of Legion Devil Grunts who are minions, fairly low-level minions, six-level minions. Just the cannon fodder for the party to slice through. And then a couple of Cambion Hell Swords to act as sort of the main bodyguards. They're eighth level brutes. And where that sort of jived for me in my head was the Pain Devil Captain has a power that gives allies that use weapons five additional fire damage. And the Cambions and the Grunts are all using weapons, so their attacks would all get an extra damage, sort of syncing this whole encounter together and have it make sense a little more.
Sure, and something to actually, the Pain Devil Captain also has Supreme Sadism, which when he bloodies an enemy, all allies in five squares gain 10 temporary hit points.
Right.
Now, if the Legion, that's interesting to use with minions because it gives minions some padding. But that's going to have to be the problem, though, is that in this situation, that the minions wouldn't be able to realize that benefit because it'd be gone by the time he bloodies anybody in the group. Uh-huh. So what I might suggest is you might stock this encounter with, and remember, we can always go over up to the point where you're one level below. So what I might start with is actually have some human servants first, and there may be some guys and you can easily reskin a Legion Devil to be a human without having to do any kind of mechanical work. But actually start the encounter with a couple of human minions first. And then maybe once the Pain Devil Captain or once those guys die off or whatever, the Pain Devil Captain then summons in the Legion Devils at like a midpoint in the encounter to turn it to add an extra complication.
Sure.
And so I'm a full believer in delaying minion appearance because I think that minions, especially early in 4th edition, minions just became kind of like speed bumps. And I think minions have a lot. They can be super interesting if they are actually appear incrementally. So you might have a few at the start of the encounter, a couple more appear in the midpoint, and then a couple of the others. Then the last smatterings might come in at the very end when the Pain Devil Captain's on the ropes.
Sure. Now I have another. Sure. I have another idea. As you were talking about that, that could also work, is because I have this image of while the party's going in after the Pain Devil Captain, maybe he's already in the middle of some sort of vile ritual human sacrifice. And the combat begins when he kills off this human sacrifice. You know, the talking is over and he stabs his knife into the heart of this human sacrifice. He's got chained up on the altar in front of him, which allows him to kill somebody. and give the minions their 5 temporary hit points.
Right. Well, that could work. However, the only motivation for the evil PCs to stop him would be to avoid giving the minion the temporary hit points. It would be interesting if the sacrifice was actually the Templar that the PCs are employed, they're working for. Now, that would also require shifting how the PCs see him, and so maybe the PCs need an extra motivation to keep him alive.
Mm-hmm.
So him alive would, and maybe that, you know, and of course, as a DM, you could say, well, if the bad guy actually kills him, then you could bring back the Templar as a revenant or something like that, and maybe come back and get revenge on the PCs within shapes of the Paragon Tier. But if maybe the Templar is blackmailing one of the player characters, that gives that particular player character, that particular player, a motivation for doing something that actually is at odds with his alignment, or might be construed as being at odds with his alignment,
mm-hmm.
and doing something like this, sacrifice himself to save his employer, even though he hates his employer. That could be an interesting twist.
Yeah, I could see a lot of things fitting into that. Like, you know, use the PC's backgrounds a little bit. You know, they've got family that they're trying to protect or whatever, you know, but the Templar's got a standing order that if he dies, they're to be killed, you know, or even take a magical means to it of, you know, the PCs, because this Templar knows that they're going to be dangerous, right? So naturally he would want to protect himself. And so he's magically put something in them, you know, if I die, then, you know, your brain explodes or whatever.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I mean, doing anything that can, because that's kind of what I was talking about earlier on, but trying to manage the player characters, the evil player characters ahead of time, and having those kind of tools and techniques in place before the campaign starts, or to seed those into the game, helps you keep the player, you know, helps things from devolving into a carnage fest, which no one really wants for any kind of campaign.
Sure.
Something else I would probably also suggest would be when you're going through these stat blocks, especially with a Pain Devil Captain, you may want to just, and the Legion Devils, you may want to just take an eye on, in order to kind of nudge the challenge a little higher, maybe adjust the damage upwards just a hair.
Mm-hmm.
The Pain Devil Captain does an extra 5 fire damage, but he's an 11th level guy. The Close Burst 10 is pretty big, but that's a power that's going to get weaker and weaker as a fight progresses. So what I might do would be either scale up the extra fire damage, because if the PCs are 8th or 9th level, I think you could probably either up it to 7 fire damage, or do 5 fire damage and ongoing 3 fire damage every time they're hit.
Hmm.
And then do something like that, and just pencil that in or on a post-it note, just to change it. Or if that seems too arduous, then maybe what you could do would be to add terrain effects in the room that says that gives an extra spike on top of that. So that you might have Legion Devils who are, you know, within 2 squares of a font of fire, of hellfire, might get might do ongoing 3 fire damage on a hit with an attack. That could be pretty interesting.
And and sort of along those lines, I'd also considered adding one more monster that's a bit higher level, that would be sort of the number 2, the second in command under the Pain Devil Captain. I was specifically thinking of a Chain Devil, mostly because I really like Chain Devils. I really like the Chitons and their appearance and story and what have you. But he doesn't fit in as well in terms of being a weapon user, because the chains aren't considered weapons.
Right.
But that would also be a way to ramp up the danger a little bit. But it also ramps up the complexity, because it's one more creature for the DM to run.
That's true. And what the Cambion Hell Swords are level 8 brutes. Right. So they're going to be able to. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So they're going to be able to soak up some of the damage. Chain Devil would add a lot as far as complexity. I mean, the Pain Devil Captain is not that difficult of a stat block to run from. He's going to have, on his turn, he's going to do either Ignite Weaponry or Scourge. And then you really only have to worry about his Supreme Sadism probably once or twice at encounter. And then he's got his Aura of Torment, which is going to do a little damage. I'd probably also up that too, but that's just because I'm a schmuck. So the Chain Devil, though, I think the Chain Devil is a fairly complex stat block, and I think it would probably be pretty interesting, though, especially if he was a late arrival.
Sure.
I think it'd be kind of neat if you go in the room and you've got the two hell swords that kind of move to block the PC's progress. You might delay the minions till a second round. Actually, if you have human minions like sacrifices or cultists or thralls or whatever, and you could use human some seventh level minion or whatever, they're not going to do any damage. They're only going to be there to soak hits and keep those characters distracted. Maybe, oh, here you go. So what you could actually have would be maybe these minions that are enthralled by the Pain Devil Captain, the human ones, are actually, the PCs might notice they're all covered in these runes, and they've been painted, their bodies have been painted with some sort of arcane script. And as they, and once the PCs, you know, gun them down, their sacrifices by the PCs causes the Chain Devil to become summoned. So if the PCs can contain them, keep them alive, it would delay the entry of the Chain Devil. Chain Devil is going to add 600 XP to the encounter, so it might nudge it up if he shows up. But it'd be also pretty cool if the characters can figure this out, maybe by incorporating a skill challenge in this too, if they could figure out a way to contain those minions without killing them. And you might say that the Chain Devil comes in bloodied if only two minions are killed, or in full strength if all four are killed. That could be pretty neat.
Yeah, that sounds. This encounter is really taking on a really fun story and has become a really dynamic sort of encounter. Any other bits of thoughts or advice or suggestions on how to take this encounter and or encounters in general for evil PCs and make them awesome? Because I think what we developed here.
Yeah, I think this would be a lot of fun to kind of run through. Because I think the one thing I think that encounters really need to have are, and I mean, I know I'm guilty of this, and I know and it's having multiple ways of actually establishing a victory point up front, and then having multiple paths to victory. So, I mean, you know, every encounter is basically, could easily end up being just exchanging hits until one side's dead. But having ways to circumvent that kind of method or system is always much more rewarding for the players. I mean, I think as DMs, there is a tendency in some of us to say, well, I've got 110 hit points, and damn it, my players are going to chew away at every 110 of those hit points. I think that you could do certain victory conditions can be achieved within a combat encounter that can equate to a hit or reducing the hit point chunk down by a certain amount. So like what we're talking about with like the characters might, if they're really aggressive, if they're really aggressive and take out those minions, then the counter becomes more complicated. But if they hold back and think about the fight and try to control it another way, the fight becomes easier because they don't have to fight the Chain Devil at the end of the fight. So that's one of the situations where it's a player-driven choice, and the consequences for their actions are then realized immediately. And I think that's actually, and I think if more encounters did that, well, I think a lot of encounters should be doing that, where not necessarily in that situation or that level of complexity, but I think players will have a much more rewarding and a memorable experience by trying to find different ways to overcome their challenges. And this is a good way, I think, and I think what we've come up with today is probably pretty much nails it, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think you could even put another level of complexity and another option to end the encounter. Maybe as part of figuring out what's going on with the minions and if you kill them, they're going to summon the Chain Devil. You could also add another level of when you learn that, you also figure out that, you know, the inscriptions along the walls or whatever are what's sustaining the Pain Devil in this realm, and maybe incorporate another little skill challenge in there or continuation of the skill challenge to banish the Pain Devil and not have to defeat him as yet another option.
Totally. Yeah. And I think it's there's a danger of going with too big of complexity skill challenges, like a complexity 5.
Yeah.
Although I think in this situation you could do it where you have a skill challenge that's mapped over top of the regular combat encounter. And if you could, and if you sit down and run your numbers as far as how much your XP budget is going to count up for, you might say the Pain Devil Captain and the Chain Devil are worth 1,200 experience points together. You could have the skill challenge be also equal to 1,200 experience points, and then figure out, and then set your DCs and all that stuff by that, and break it up into smaller chunks. So as you were saying, that you figure out that the human sacrifices that are rabid, that's one part of it's one component of the skill challenge. You could kill them, and then it auto fails, and then guess what? The Chain Devil shows up. But that takes part of the first part. And then, as you were saying, for the arcane script on the walls, it sustains the Pain Devil Captain. What you might want to do in that case if you don't want to make it a way to defeat the encounter, but rather a way that the Pain Devil can kind of compensate or get a buff, maybe the Pain Devil has is that when he starts this, whenever he hits an enemy, he has a special terrain power that whenever, because it, that may tie into a sadism bit, that whenever he deals damage to an enemy, as long as he's within 70 squares mm-hmm. of the arcane script, he gets either a plus two boost to his accuracy on a melee attack, or maybe he can actually create another Legion Devil. That because Legion Devils are so disposable. So yeah, you could probably, and that may be that, that's something else that he could do. Another complication that, that could be thrown at the PCs, where yeah, I like that idea because if he's got the arcane, maybe he's got a hermetic circle, and if he's within three squares of that circle, every time he deals damage to a PC, a Legion Devil pops up. And I think you've got to control that by saying that maybe there's a recharge on that mechanic, but it allows it actually within give you a way to delay the entry of the Legion Devil minions.
Mm-hmm.
But also mm-hmm. it opens it up so you can use more of them, so that in case you know one lucky roll with an area burst power doesn't you know shift the battle tide all of a sudden.
Yeah, very cool. I think we've got a good encounter here for people to use. And along with that, I'm going to turn it over now to Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com for one of his awesome mini advice segments for DMs.
Hey, it's your pal Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com and Twitter.com/SlyFlourish. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about being an evil dungeon master. You've heard today about being an evil player character, running an evil player character, or playing in an evil campaign. But what are some things that you can do to be a little bit more of an evil dungeon master without getting all of your players to leave your table and leave you sitting there by yourself with your bag of Cheetos? Well, I have three tips for you today that you might add to your game to add a little bit more excitement and to make navigating the story that you're going to unfold a little bit more challenging for the players. The first tip I have for you is how to handle betrayal. Betrayal is, of course, a great way to be an evil dungeon master, to have somebody that the players trusted and suddenly have them turn on them. Now, the easiest way to do that is with an NPC. You have an NPC that the players have been interacting with for a long time, and it suddenly turns out that that NPC has been working against them this whole time. You'll want to know what NPC is doing that early. You'll want to make sure that by the time you've created that NPC, you know that that NPC is betraying them. And you'll want the evidence to pile up over time. You don't want some big reveal where it suddenly turns out that the Duke they've been working with has been betraying his king all this time. You want evidence to pile up so that suddenly the players realize, oh, the Duke has been betraying us this whole time. We got to stop that guy. It's a lot more interesting when they find it out on their own. Now, the other interesting way to add betrayal into your game is to have one of the player characters actually be betraying the rest of the party. This works really well in one-shot games, and it might work pretty well for a short campaign. In a longer campaign, some feelings might get hurt, so you want to be a little bit careful with it. Like the NPC, you want evidence to mount up over time, so that it's the other players who figure out that they're being betrayed, rather than some big reveal. You'll be tempted to have that big reveal because you want that moment where they're all standing there staring at you in shock. But it's a little bit more interesting when they're the ones who come up with the evidence that make them stand there staring in shock. So add those little bits of evidence as you go. But be careful because you don't want them to discover it too soon. Another tip for being an evil dungeon master is to add lots of damned if you do, damned if you don't choices, both into your story and your mechanics. If you've played Dragon Age, you've seen this before. Dragon Age has lots of times in the game where you have to choose one direction or another, and neither of them seem like the right choice, or both of them offer advantages over the other, and you really, you know, anybody could choose one over the other. There's no presupposed direction. The more choices you can add like this into your game, the more your players will squirm. For example, maybe they're hunting down an evil necromancer and they really need to destroy him, but it turns out that that necromancer has a vital piece of information or a vital artifact that's required to save thousands of people. The more you can add choices like that into your game, the better your players will like it, and the more interesting story you'll have by the end, based on all of these different conflicting choices that they've made. You can also add damned if you do, damned if you don't choices to the mechanics in your game. You might have an altar in the center of a room, and if a player properly channels the evil energy of that altar into their attack, they can increase their critical threat range to 16 to 20. But if they fail to channel that energy with a failed endurance check or something like that, they can end up taking ongoing 20 psychic damage. So now you can create mechanics that offer those same damned if you do, damned if you don't choices. Choices where that risk, the benefit might be great, but the risk is just as equally great. And now your players are squirming, deciding whether or not they want to channel such a powerful force. The third tip I have for you is to add some conflicting quests into your game. if you give individual secret quests to the different players that are playing, you can have those quests actually conflict with one another, and they won't know it until the moment actually reveals itself. So, for example, you might have a sword that's been possessed by an evil entity, and one person gets the quest to find the sword and destroy it. The other person gets the quest to find the sword and use it to destroy an even greater evil. If neither of them know about the other's quest, they won't actually occur until they have the sword in hand. One person's trying to destroy it, and one person's trying to hold on to it. You might have another situation where you're trying to hunt down a murderer, and one person's saying, I need to return the murderer to justice. And the other person is saying, I need to kill that murderer on the spot, because if I bring him back, he'll never face justice. Well, now you have some interesting choices that get made early on. So whenever you can find ways for quests to overlap or have conflicting goals and give those quests to different players, that can bring up some really interesting drama into your game. So those are three ways that you can be a little bit more of an evil dungeon master. If you like these tips, please visit slyflourish.com or visit me on Twitter at twitter.com/slyflourish. Thank you very much.
Now it's time to take a quick moment to mention our second sponsor of the episode, NobleKnightGames.com, where my pick for the episode is The Pirate's Guide to Freeport. Freeport is a fantastic setting that combines pirates and otherworldly horror and more. This book is all setting and no rules, so it can be played with any game, even though it came out a couple years ago. And Freeport is a very complex setting with a lot going on. I wonder if there's anybody out there that happens to be on the line with me right now that could share some ideas about what Freeport really is at its core.
You might. Freeport was one of the things I was most proud of during my time at Green Run of Publishing. Freeport has always been Chris Pramus's baby, and we did support products for it. We did the Crisis in Freeport adventure, and then we eventually relaunched Dark Wings over Freeport by Rob Vaughn as another adventure. But we were all building towards kind of a relaunch of the setting, because at various points some weirdness did creep into the setting that either we kind of regretted or didn't really want to support going forward. So at that time, there was a lot of rumors flying about fourth edition's imminence, and so we were questioned whether or not it would be a good idea to do a third edition version of the book and another third edition version of the book. So we decided that at a meeting at a summit that we would do a systemless book that would basically make it edition proof. And I think we succeeded because there's enough information in that book that even though there are no mechanics in it, there's enough to keep any gaming group busy, regardless of the system they play, for pretty much as long as they want. And Freeport does mix; it does have a perfect mix of orcs and pirates and Lovecraftian goodness, murder and mayhem, and all the other good kind of nastiness that I kind of like to bring to my D&D games.
Yeah, I've been playing a third edition play by email game that started with the original Freeport trilogy, and now we're well into. Probably our sixth or seventh published adventure using Freeport as a setting. And it is a setting that can fit anywhere pretty easily on its own. I mean, we're playing Freeport as part of the Forgotten Realms. But is its own unique thing and islands out in the ways, but has a lot of really engaging story to it.
And yeah, that was a...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to say that that was one of the things that we wanted to preserve with the systemless book, was to maintain its utility in any setting. But at the same time, we realized that some people might want to have a bigger world to kind of stomp around in. And so that's why we added an appendix, which actually kind of talks about the larger world of Freeport, mm-hmm. which was something we hinted at the Hominoptera box set, and then also the Mind Shadows Mythic Vistas setting, and a variety, and even the Bleeding Edge adventures were all set in the larger world of Freeport.
And if people want more of the crunch to sort of support this systemless book, there is a True 20, a D20, and recently a fourth edition compendium or add-on, I guess, that supports this setting book with more crunch and statistics and things to help people along with that. So that is The Pirate's Guide to Freeport, available at NobleKnightGames.com, currently for $30.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, so now we're going to get into our second bit of advice, this one aimed at players and playing an evil character in a party. Which, I guess, advice on how to do that is different depending on what the rest of the party looks like, right? There's playing an evil PC in a non-evil party. You know, you're the one bad guy in the party. And there's also being part of a largely evil party. And those are two kind of different bits of advice, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, there's a – both of them bring challenge. Both of them bring their own challenges. And I think that – but they also can both – create some very interesting role-playing opportunities as well as some neat story things as well. At various points in my gaming career, I've had players who have played evil characters, like I'm sure every other DM that's out there has as well. And there are two major styles for us, the individual evil NPC, evil player character that I kind of see. One is the DMG calls it the instigator. And this is a character that kind of goes out and causes trouble. I find these types of evil characters are more destructive and can unravel a campaign. They can unravel a campaign faster than pretty much anything. I've got one of those in my game right now, and he's a half-orc whirling barbarian, and he causes trouble. And how to deal with that, I'll talk about in a second. The other one is a character who hides their alignment and tries to work with the rest of the PCs, the rest of the party, while pursuing his or her own agenda. And my friend David Berenger, who I haven't seen in many years, played an evil conjurer in second edition named Shara, and she was fantastic. And because she spent the life of the campaign, which went for 6 or 7 years, played this evil character and had the alignment pretty much fairly well for the entire time, despite the fact that the detect alignment spells were available. But she worked with the party, and I helped him create situations where it was in the party's interest to keep this character around. And so when the campaign finally came to its end and her betrayal, and she finally turned against the party, it was a really awesome moment that has still lived on, even now 10 years after that. So, but yeah, I think those are the two, for me, those are the two bigger types, two big archetypes for individual characters. And as you were saying, that an evil party creates an entirely different situation. And I mentioned this earlier, I think that with an evil party, the few times I've actually played in an evil party, if it doesn't end in tragedy where everyone turns on each other, and then it becomes kind of this exercise of gross out. You know, how far will you be willing to go? And if knowing me, I can go pretty far. And, it just wasn't very much fun for anyone involved. So I think the thing that you've got, I think, so in large broad strokes, I would say the first thing that if you're thinking about playing an evil PC, really consider the consequences up front. And this may be fairly obvious, but you know, you're here to play the game to ensure that you have a good time, but also you have a responsibility to make sure your fellow players have a good time. And if your character choice is going to impinge on somebody else's good time, it's probably best to think of something else. However, if you've got a fairly cosmopolitan group and they're interested in testing the limits of their role-playing comfort level, then I think an evil character can add an interesting dynamic to any group. Proceed with caution. As far as the destructive PC goes, I think for a DM, for the player, you know, stop it. But for the DM, I think that it's to control that character, but rather to constrain or to limit the amount of destruction this character can cause, is to create situations that test this character. Do things to keep them busy. If they want to go on a murderous rampage, then let it happen off screen. So if you want this character, if this player wants to go ahead and murder somebody, that an NPC that either betrayed or troubled the PCs, then just let it happen and let it happen off stage, and you're not paying any attention to it. You're not necessarily paying attention. You're not ignoring it. You're letting the player do what his character would do, but it's not detracting from the rest of the play experience, everyone around at the table. And you may do that. You may handle those kind of scenarios through role playing, via email or through through text message or whatever, or even a special private session. But it does allow. But it does keep that evil character. It does allow that evil character to do what he does, but without kind of bleeding into the rest of the party and compromising their stories as well. Because I find that these characters tend to go off on their own and do things that the other party would object to.
One of the things I might also add to that conversation then is it would probably be a good idea if you're playing that evil PC, it's not all the DM's job to sort of control you and contain you and keep your acts hidden or whatever. I would also put some of that responsibility on the player, and I think it's important to consider that you may be evil, but you're still a person, you know? And people are complex creatures. And I think the most compelling way to play an evil PC is to play an evil PC that doesn't think he's the evil one. You know, the most compelling evil characters in literature or games tend to be ones who fully believe they're the good guy. And I think if you believe you're the good guy, then there's a way of incorporating you into the party and maybe give you connections to other players, because fourth edition is very much designed to be a collaborative group effort, right? So if you have, you know, maybe one of the, you know, not to to lean too heavily on heavily other used stories, but if you're the evil PC and your brother is a good PC in the group or what have you, then that gives you some connection and that allow that other character to sort of rein you in. You know, maybe you really want to go out there and torture that guy to figure out the information, but when so-and-so objects, then you allow them to have their way.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really important point, is that it seems a lot of people who think that once they slap the evil or chaotic evil alignment on their character sheets, that it's just licensed to play a caricature of an evil character. But as you mentioned, that, you know, this isn't the character is far more complex than what the alignment actually, that one word can actually summarize. And just because you're evil doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to choose the evil choice every time. You might be an a paladin of Vecna, for example. Does that mean that your character is going to go ahead and murder babies and burn down the village? Probably not. But what it does mean is that you might withhold information from another NPC, or you might hoard secrets, or you might use dubious magic items or dark rituals to achieve your story goals. And I think that you're right. It is as much as it is DM's prerogative to try to create situations where these characters can act within a acceptable parameter. It's also the player's duty, and not just duty. It sounds a little too moralistic, but it's player's kind of responsibility to also find a way to portray this character in an interesting way that doesn't necessarily make it destructive to the rest of the party, and still allows you to function within the team.
And I would say, I would even take it to a point of saying, look, if you're going to play that character, be aware that ultimately most evil characters in stories tend to eventually betray the group.
Or find redemption.
Absolutely. Those sort of end up being the two options. So either be open to finding redemption for your evil character, or be willing to accept that you may betray the group and that takes this character out of your hands. You know, maybe you're there for the final betrayal, and work with your DM to tell that story and make that meaningful to the larger campaign, and then be willing to step away and play another character and let the DM have your character, or have your character die tragically at the moment of betrayal or what have you. But either way, at that point, that character, after that one encounter or so, that character has become the villain. And I think you got to be willing to step away from it at that point and play something else.
Totally. And we've got not to talk too much about my own characters, but we have another character in my Sunday night game who actually went through something very similar. And he's a Raven Queen worshiper, but it's kind of a darker side of that. And his solution is pretty much anybody who's in trouble, they should be invincible-fying it. But he believes that he should be the dispenser of death for those people who that death would serve best. So he comes across somebody that might be saved by a magical ritual. He'd sooner just shoot them and speed them on their way to the Raven Queen to whatever after rewards and waits in the afterworld. Well, this naturally causes tensions in the group, and last night he made his exit. So, I mean, and he's been, and from the very start, he told me that, you know, his story, he wasn't sure how his character would eventually exit the game. You know, he would like to see the character go to the end, and do that by achieving some sort of moment, some sort of salvation at some point. But based on the other players' options and choices, he felt that there was no way that he could reconcile his own person, his character's overarching objectives with their own interests. Mm-hmm. And so now this character is shifting over to become probably a campaign villain, or at least a foil for a while. Until something may happen and he may reunite with them later on if he finds the redemption that the character needs. So it's pretty interesting.
Very cool.
Now this all shifts in a strange way though once you have an entire party composed of evil characters.
Right.
And in that case, you know, I think some of the same things are still true. And if you look at the Black Company novels, those characters probably aren't paragons of virtue for the most part. And in fact, some of those characters that are members of the Black Company are probably pretty bad people generally, but they still can actually achieve some good in the world, even if they're using it through unconventional means. This is a group of mercenaries who will work for whoever, but at the same time, they may engage in dubious activities. I think an evil adventuring or unaligned to evil adventuring party can operate in the same methods if we consider that each individual character has varying shades that is not just going to act in a typically evil fashion. He may have some areas where he or she may have some areas where you commit the dark deed, but overall it's a complex functioning individual that has darker motivations or a dark habit or something along those lines. And to reiterate, you were saying forging links between characters, evil characters, evil and unaligned characters in the same party is a really good way to prevent it from self-destructing. If these characters are bound, as we said earlier, as by a common patron, or if they have a shared background, like they were enthralled by a super oppressive religious state, or they escaped from a mine or a prison complex, all these types of things can help kind of reinforce the bond because they all have a shared heritage.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I think that could be a huge help in terms of having an all evil party is. Before the game even starts, those players need to get together and discuss their party and develop the party and build that as much as they build a character, because you want to make sure that this isn't going to be a party that just implodes on itself, you know, two levels into the game.
Yeah, actually, to take it a step further, I think every, you know, I'm kind of the opinion that I think every gaming group should operate that way.
Sure.
I think we've already walked the road of, you know, you all meet in a tavern. And you know, in Greyhawk, and now you're a disparate band of adventurers that have to overcome your differences and work together. We've already seen that story. I think we can cut that part off. And I think games are if players work together up front and establish their interrelationships between those characters, and they kind of and make their decisions not based on optimizing their particular character, but make their decisions based on the shared story. I think that creates a much more interesting experience as far as role playing and also keeping that party together and coherent. It, as they develop and gain levels and undertake adventures. And that's one of the things that I think that, you know, is one of the areas I'd really like to develop as a designer is find ways that we can encourage that style of gameplay, either through DDI or whatever.
Mm-hmm,
but I really like the idea of a party template that kind of hooks everybody together and has different ways that people can kind of step in and join into that group mindset.
Good. Absolutely. So any other bits of last second advice here for playing evil characters if you're a player?
As a player, I think that as a player, the other thing, one other thing I would also want to mention is that if you're going to go the route of an evil party or an evil character, there's going to be some reskinning on your end, usually, in regards to, and I think it's reskinning of your powers or, mostly powers. And why I think this is important is that powers are, as written, the story content that kind of surrounds a power is there to kind of help ground that power in the world. but that story content can change based on the character that's assigned to. So if you've got Cleave, for example, as a fighter, you know, we all know it does one weapon plus strength modifier on a hit and spill over strength damage to another target. You might change how this works, where it's like, and maybe this is a bad example, but what you might do is that the math doesn't change, but how you portray this power in gameplay can add more flavor and more story to your character. So when you make your cleave attack, you might describe your character crunching into the first guy and then whipping back your battle axe into somebody else, a bystander, without really caring and without paying any attention at all. You become a paragon of slaughter, for example. Okay. And same thing is true for like divine characters as well. Like if you're a paladin, you might have some radiant stuff that may not make sense if you're a cleric of Vecna. Working with your DM to just swap those out for necrotic or some other damage type certainly is reasonable in order to portray your character's power suite and his concept. So I think a little bit more flexibility is probably required when you're really into the darker side of character options.
And if people want more advice on reskinning characters, they can go back to our previous advice episode with Chris Sims, who we talked about that at length. So that would be good advice there as well. All right. So there's our bit of advice for players. Now we're going to turn it over to Tracy Hurley from SarahDarkMagic.com, who's going to give us some player advice given the possible shifting nature or shifting desires that people seem to be wanting to get out of 4th edition, like more and more people getting gritty and wanting to play evil characters.
Hi, this is Tracy from SarahDarkMagic.com. With some of the products coming out for 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons, I think we're seeing a bit of a shift in play styles towards competitiveness, pitting players against the environment, each other, the DM, or even random chance. This month I want to discuss this trend and how not to be a jerk about it if it comes up at your gaming table. So what makes me think there's a shift? One example is the release of the Deck of Many Things a few months ago to DDI subscribers. The Deck of Many Things is a chaotic and dangerous artifact that has appeared in every edition of D&D. As an artifact to its goals, namely to sow chaos and discord throughout the world, and these goals are often at odds with adventuring parties. Using this artifact in a game brings random chance to the table in a way not often seen in 4th edition items. While the deck is a very specific example, the upcoming release of Dark Sun is a more general one. Dark Sun is a harsh place. Bloodsport provides popular entertainment. Many are enslaved and most of the lands are ruled by powerful sorcerer kings. Travel is difficult and often life-draining, and even the gods are silent. Then there's the update to the Tomb of Horrors, a classic D&D module where the object is often just seeing how far you get before you die. Traps abound and TPKs are common. Furthermore, this shift is even reflected in a number of blog posts and Twitter conversations with fans asking for things like cursed items, and perhaps even an evil PC or three. I know Quinn Murphy of the popular At Will blog has a few posts about cursed items on his site, and he's run at least one adventure with evil PCs. Overall, I think this is a necessary change. Heroic acts are great, but without great risk, they seem a little, well, common. Good need not always win, and sometimes a PC dies an uninteresting death. Besides, playing with the same expectations game after game gets a bit boring with time. Sometimes I want to play that shining knight on a white horse and rescue the kingdom from certain doom using my mind as much as my sword. But other times I just want to duke it out in an arena match, gladiator style. But it does bring up a problem. When we, as players, feel we've been set up to fail, we're not always gracious about it. Let's be honest, too often we act like total jerks. We turn this into a battle of wills between us and the other players, usually the DM. We start thinking about how we can annoy or harass the player, or how we can push forward for a TPK and a fresh start. It quickly becomes a mess. So what should we do instead? First, whenever we want to change the play style of the group, we should send some feelers out to the DM and potentially the other players. Sure, it might ruin some of the fun of surprise, but even if you really know the group, surprise can lead to hurt feelings and nastiness. If one of my friends suddenly stabbed my character in the back without warning, I might wonder if I did something to cause that action, rather than assume the player was bored with his character being a nice guy. And well, I would silently curse the guy if I had to create a new character sheet. One thing to keep in mind is how you bring your idea to the group. Consider asking people individually about the change. There's a lot of social pressure to say yes in a group, and while you might get your way, you might not get what you want. If you can meet in person, that's even better. If you're advocating a radical change, you might want to pick some neutral ground. Share your idea over some food and drink in a relaxed atmosphere. Also, try to find ways that the change can fit in with the needs of the other group members. For instance, bringing an evil character who just harasses the other members of the party might be too annoying, but an evil character whose interests are aligned with the party might work just fine. Be prepared to compromise, and try to separate out what you desire from the change from the specifics, if possible. For instance, maybe you're tired of playing in a group that feels like they always have to do the right thing, and you would like to add a bit of chaos instead. A number of tools exist to bring the chaos, the deck of many things, cursed items, etc. A person who balks at one implementation might be fine with another. Keep in mind that items that might be great to you, particularly for reasons of nostalgia, might be scary to others, especially new players. When I had a DM pull out a critical miss deck for the first time, I almost bolted from the table. He noticed my reaction, but instead of getting upset, he asked me what my concerns were. When I explained that I was afraid of the weapon breakage cards and losing my magic weapon, he totally understood and just removed those cards from the deck. With them gone, I really enjoyed playing the deck and might even bring it to my own table sometime. If others are requesting the change, try to hear them out before saying no. Perhaps the DM is a competitive sort normally and just wants to run one or two sessions with a different feel. Or some of the players might be feeling a bit nostalgic and wish to give a new version of Tomohara's a try. With so many motivations for playing, the cooperative style isn't going to suit everyone all the time. Why not give some alternate playstyles a try? Besides, you might be surprised to find that you like the slightly different feel, or at least it'll help you appreciate your preferred style all the more. And when you want to shake things up a bit yourself, you might get some more support for your ideas.
All right, so let's summarize real quick what we talked about. We started off building an encounter for PCs who are evil. And we talked about using a patron to sort of bind them together. We said not to ignore the character's motivations. You know, figure out what drives them and use that to keep them focused on those motivations instead of on each other. And maybe keep the story in general more tightly focused or controlled, so that they just don't have an open sandbox to wreak havoc. Does that summarize what we said in that section pretty well?
I think you nailed it.
All right. And then when we talked about playing an evil PC, we talked about possibly having some of your evil acts happen off screen or be contained so that the other party members, if they're not evil, don't have to deal with you every time you do something that's horrible. But also be willing to exit the game if necessary. And remember that your PC is human, or not human, but is a person, you know, with a personality. And that's lots of shades of gray, not just you're all evil, and that you have different motivations beyond just being evil. So maybe also connect that character to some other characters, and or generally just allow your evil to be reined in if necessary to keep the group together and keep the game moving forward so everybody can have fun. Does that summarize that?
Totally does. You've been paying attention.
I try. All right. Well, then that is episode 141. I want to start off by thanking our sponsors, FRP Games and Noble Knight Games. And I really want to thank our guest of the episode, Robert J. Schwab. Where can people go to find you, to reach out to you? If people want to ask you questions or what have you, where can they go?
I have robertjschwab.com. That's a new website that's going live in another week or so. You can also follow me on Twitter at rjschwab. And I'm also on Facebook. Just look for Robert J. Schwab, and that's where you'll find me.
All right. So you're pretty easy to get a hold of, and people should. I know I've been impressed with your work since I first saw – I think I first started recognizing your name when – was it – what were the two Devil and Demon books for third edition that came out? They were the
– Fiendish Codex.
Yeah, the Fiendish Codex. I wanted to say Fiend Folio, and I knew that wasn't right. Yeah, the Fiendish Codex 2 was the first time I really started recognizing your name. So,
well, thanks very much for having me. I've had a great time.
Yeah, it's been good having you here. People can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com, visit the forums at vorpalnetwork.com, review the show on iTunes, and get out there and tell people about it to help grow the audience. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. We get part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 141, where we've delved into the depths of our souls and pulled out the darkest, most vile parts of ourselves and discovered that despite everything that's being said about him, Robert J. Schwab's really not that bad of a fellow. And he has some pretty good...
Shucks.
Say that again.
I said, aw, shucks.
Yeah. And he has some pretty good advice for having evil PCs in a game in this episode of...
I'm on the wall.